Hello everyone, this is Bob Zeta by amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today in digest format, World Radio Online, for the month of July 2011. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website, a very fine one indeed, www.handyham.org. Let's begin today in World Radio Online Newsfront. The FCC proposes hike in vanity call sign fee. A notice of proposed rulemaking released by the Federal Communications Commission on May 3 calls for an increase in the fee for amateur radio vanity call signs. If the proposal is approved, vanity calls will hike to $14.20, and that's a 90-cent increase from the current $13.30. Amateur radio licenses must be renewed every 10 years. The Communications Act of 1934, as amended, authorizes the FCC to collect vanity call sign fees to recover the costs associated with that program. The vanity call sign regulatory fee is paid when applying for a new vanity call sign and upon renewal for a new term. Vanity call signs issued prior to 1996 are exempt from having to pay the renewal fee. American amateur shot dead at Kabul Airport. U.S. radio amateur James McLaughlin, WA2EWE/T6AF, was among the 9 Americans killed in a shootout at Kabul Airport in April when an Afghan military pilot opened fire in an operations room of the Afghan Air Corps, according to Voice of America reporter and fellow amateur Steve Herman. Call W7VOA/T6AD. According to Herman, the attack was the worst single episode of an Afghan turning against his coalition partners. Writing from Seoul, where he is chief of the Voice of America Bureau, Herman said McLaughlin, who was also a friend, was a career U.S. military officer working as a contractor training Afghan pilots. They first met August 2009 and were the only two hams operating in Kabul. Jim had put together a fine radio shack in his quarters, Herman wrote, adding, it was obvious from spending time with Jim that ham radio was an important, morale-boosting pastime, and he usually spent a couple of hours per day on the air, logging thousands of QSOs. That commentary was provided by CQ Newsroom. CBO, the price tag of ARRL-backed steady, equals $1 million. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has projected that conducting the studies mandated by S-191, that's the Senate bill, the Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Enactment Act of 2011, will cost taxpayers approximately $1 million in 2012 if passed and signed into law. The bill, which is being heavily promoted by the American Radio Relay League, would direct the Department of Homeland Security to study the uses and capabilities of the amateur radio service during and after a disaster or emergency, and would require the Department's Inspector General additionally to report on the cost of grant programs administered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the extent to which these programs overlap with each other. The CBO analysis was requested by the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Prominent amateurs become silent keys. They have passed on. Four amateur radio and luminaries became silent keys in recent months. Paul Barron, called W3KAS, died in March from complications of lung cancer. Barron was one of the fathers of the Internet and of packet radio. He came up with the idea of packet switching, in which data to be transmitted is broken up into small segments, sent over sometimes varying routes, and reassembled at its destination. Mike Koss, spelled K-O-S-S, call W-9-S-U, owner of Industrial Communications Engineers, ICE, died unexpectedly after collapsing on his workshop floor. ICE, well known among hams as a manufacturer of line filters, surge protectors, and more, temporarily suspended taking new orders while it reorganized the business in light of Koss's passing. Roger Nichols, KE4BDA, Grammy-winning recording engineer, died in April after a battle with pancreatic cancer. Nichols, 66, was best known for his work with Steely Dan and was honored with 3 Grammys. And Leo Meyerson, called W0GFQ-XW9GFQ, died in April, a few weeks after celebrating his 100th birthday. Meyerson founded and ran World Radio Laboratories in Council Bluffs, Iowa, producing the Globe line of transmitters popular among hams in the mid-20th century. CQ amateur radio columnist Joe Eisenberg, called K0NEB, was a family friend of Meyerson's. Joe shares reflections on the man who was also his personal ham radio mentor in his kit-building column in the magazine's July issue. We thank CQ Newsroom for all those obituaries. The Maritime Network assisted in the rescue of a man and a dog. A 77-year-old sailor and his dog were rescued by the U.S. Coast Guard after being stranded at sea. With help from ham radio operators of the Maritime Mobile Service Net, according to a posting on the CQ Newsroom blog. On March 21, Net member Rex Weiheimer, KC5AGO, picked up a weak distress call on 14.300 megahertz from a disabled sailing vessel. AGO told ABC News conditions were very poor and it was nearly impossible to get information clearly. With the help of several other NET members, the group was able to piece together the boat's location and condition. The Coast Guard was notified, and the man and his dog were eventually rescued by helicopter. Neither the name of the sailor nor his dog was released. We thank ABC News for that commentary. We'll move now to the editor's log. World Radio Online editor is Richard Fisher, call KI6SN. The end of one chapter as we open another. A sad goodbye. Gerald Muir and 0WBV launched into the pages of World Radio in November 2002, back in the print era of this magazine. She modestly introduced herself to readers as the new YL's columnist, that's young ladies, in amateur radio talk. In one paragraph on page 31, tucked at the end of a 2-page spread, under the same headline, A Bit About This Columnist, she gave us a snapshot. First licensed in 93 as a Tech Plus, now an extra, ARRL Rocky Mountain Division Public Information Coordinator, District 10 Chairwoman of the Young Ladies Radio League. Oh, she did publicity on the side for YLRL as well, ARIES, World Traveler, and it went on and on. Quoting, all aspects of amateur radio, DXing to contesting to HF to VHF and more, fascinate me. Good grief. How can anyone whose plate is that full have room for dessert as World Radio YL's columnist? Remarkably, Cheryl has had her eye and ears glued to the YL's scene for World Radio and World Radio Online for almost a decade. Sadly, this month she says goodbye. Cheryl leaves an incredible portfolio of YL's news and features, which have encircled the pages of this magazine and has become a standard, we believe, by which others are measured. Her down-to-earth writing style, sprinkled with touches of humor, made her bi-monthly YLs not only accessible, but a joy to read. She knew her audience, and quite proudly, her audience knew her. Cheryl has been a valued and trusted reporter, accurate, complete, and always fair, an editor's dream. In her introduction almost 9 years ago, Cheryl wrote, "If I ever get bored with amateur radio, it will be my own fault." Somehow, we can't imagine that a possibility. We sincerely thank her for serving WRO readers so selflessly and wish her nothing but the best, perhaps with a plate not quite so full. And now, a happy hello. As saddened as we are to see a valued columnist depart, we're thrilled to welcome Jennifer Oliver O'Connell, call KI6OIL, Kilo India 6, Oscar India Lima, as she receives the YL's baton from N0WBV. You get to know Jennifer in this month's YLs and appreciate the depth she brings to WRO as a seasoned writer and reporter, among many, many other interests. I think it's fair to say Jennifer married into amateur radio and is often seen with her OM, that's her husband, Lynn, KG60NY, at ham-related events across California. Without doubt, she's an amateur radio doer, involved and enthusiastic. Jennifer's worldview will serve her as well, having had her passport stamped on mission trips to Sri Lanka, Haiti, and Ghana. Quoting, "My hope is to do a de-expedition one of these days," close quote, she says. Thank you, Jennifer. We'll be happy to come along for the ride. Here's to a great staff. Up and down the line, WRO, World Radio Online, is extremely fortunate to have a team of such outstanding columnists and writers. The 90-year legacy of W0WBV is a reminder and testimony to the fact. As KI6OIL joins the team, we all look forward to bringing you continued solid coverage of the interesting people and many facets of amateur radio. The best is yet to come. The editor's log is signed Richard Fisher, KI6SN. My lead article today will be I Remember the 1930s, Amateur Radio's Golden Years. It's a commentary by Jim Pepper, W6QIF. Do you remember when? To borrow a line from Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. So as the country was just getting out of the Great Depression, clouds of war were gathering on the horizon. It was the late 1930s. Radio's popularity in the amateur ranks was ever-growing. Television hadn't yet become a viable medium. Cell phones were only a dream. Computers were in the crudest mechanical forms. I received my first ham license in 1937 when I was in high school. Unlike many of my friends, I hadn't yet built my transmitter. They constructed their rigs and were on the air even before their licenses arrived in the mail. We called them bootleggers. My first contact was on 80 meters. I still remember it. I worked a station in San Luis Obispo, California, about 300 miles from my house. What a thrill. Becoming a radio amateur in the 30s meant passing an exam many people believe is more rigorous than today's. In most cases, becoming a ham back then meant going to the Federal Radio Commission, FRC, or Federal Communications Commission, FCC, office in a federal building known as a custom house, located in cities around the country. By the way, the Communications Act of 1934 established the Federal Communications Commission, which would replace the FRC. At the exam site, you'd first take the Morse code receiving test. To pass, at least 1 minute of the 3 minutes of text had to be copied perfectly. If you got over that hurdle, the examiner would ask you to send code at the receiving speed or higher. Next, a written test. But it was not multiple choice exam we see today. I remember being asked to draw the circuit diagram of the type of transmitter you are planning to use and briefly explain its operation. Wow. Oh, yeah. In 1933, the FRC established three classifications of amateur radio license. Class A was the highest and authorized its holder full privileges. Class B was an equivalent to today's general class license, with broad privileges except for operation on phone frequencies reserved for the Class A operator. Phone frequencies, folks, are voice frequencies. Class C had the same privileges as Class B operators, but were examined by other radio amateurs, rather than having to travel to a federal custom house. To qualify, applicants had to prove they lived more than 125 air miles from the nearest examination office. Their code and written tests were given by a Class A or B amateur operator or some otherwise qualified FRC or FCC official. Class B licenses had to wait at least 1 year before being eligible to take the Class A exam, which consisted of more difficult technical questions. All the classes were permitted to operate on 160 meters, that's 1750 to 2000 kilocycles, or KC. Today, we call them kilohertz, KHC, but that's another story. Other bands were available with certain restrictions. The phone portion of the 80-meter band was known as 75 meters and required a Class A license. The same was true for 20 meters. Can you imagine 40 meters with CW only? Again, folks, CW was continuous wave. That's what you would call Morse code, dots and dashes. And mobile operation was restricted to frequencies above 28 megacycles, MC, what we refer to as megahertz, MHZ, these days. In the VHF realm, there were the predecessors of the 6 and 2 meter bands, known back then as 5 and 2.5 meters. There were 9 call districts, one shy of today's 1 through 0. All prefixes were W, with the exception of U.S. possessions, which began with K. Hawaii, for example, was K6. Alaska was K7. In 1951, the FCC created 6 classes to replace the A, B, and C tickets we knew. Many newcomers to amateur radio started out on 80 meters, building their own transmitter, which was often crystal controlled. After calling CQ, that's asking for contacts to come back to them on the air, we detuned the entire band to see if anyone was responding to our call. Often, 2 stations in QSO were at opposite ends of the band. QSO is QSO, that's called a Q signal shorthand for two-way conversation between them. The next move was often to 160, where the addition of a modulator would put us on AM phone, amplitude modulation, voice. Of course, we'd have to change crystals and inductances to in our 80-meter transmitter circuit as well. Going from an 80-meter half-wave antenna to 160 meters meant only tuning it against ground. If you didn't have a half-wave, then a Marconi quarter-wave was the next best thing. Newcomers with the financial means would buy their receiver, while those without deep pockets generally had to build. Popular at the time were the National SW3 and the FB7 and the Hallicrafter Sky Buddy and Sky Champion. There was the Breitling 12, Patterson PR-10, Hammarlund HQ-120, and the RME-69. Almost everyone, though, built their transmitter. It was a friendly time, especially on 160. Conversations dealt mainly with signal reports and descriptions of your transmitter, from microphone to final amplifier tube. Power was measured, but in the form of input to the final stage. It was not output power to the antenna we use today. There was seldom profanity, as I remember it. Get off my frequency, and other raucous outbursts were not part of the radio amateur's operating procedure back then. Transmitting music was allowed, as I recall, for radio testing and only for short periods of time. The 1930s. You can't do that anymore, folks. No music. I certainly have enjoyed my 73 years as a radio amateur and still find time to design and build gear and, of course, getting on the air to see how it all works. That concludes Jim Pepper's commentary. I remember the 1930s, amateur radio's golden years. We have an interesting piece here from the Quarter Century Wireless Association, QCWA. Rhode Island prepares for a QCWA invasion. The author here is Dave Hayes. Call Victor Echo 3 Juliet X-ray. That's a Canadian call sign, VE3JX. It's true. Rhode Island will experience an invasion of sorts come September. However, before you call out the National Guard, let me tell you that it is a friendly invasion. And these invaders have been invited. By whom? By 5 New England chapters of the Quarter Century Wireless Association. Annually, QCWA has had a national convention for many decades. Last year was the only exception, where the main QCWA function of the year took place in conjunction with the Dayton Hamvention. In 2011, the QCWA National Convention is being hosted by QCWA's Yankee Chapter No. 112, serving Eastern Massachusetts and Rhode Island, Pine Tree Chapter No. 134 in Maine, Twin States Chapter No. 146 from New Hampshire and Vermont, Nutmeg Chapter No. 149 in Connecticut, and Pioneer Chapter No. 183, serving Central Massachusetts and North Central Connecticut. Remember these dates, September 9 through 11 of 2011. Convention Center will be the Crown Plaza Hotel at the Crossings. The address there is 801 Greenwich Avenue, Warwick, Rhode Island. Warwick is quite close to Providence, the state capital of Rhode Island, and T.F. Green Airport is only minutes away. The airport is serviced by Air Canada, Continental, Delta, Delta Connection, Northwest Airlines, Southwest, United, and U.S. Airways. Or, if you prefer rail, connections are available for Amtrak and via rail. Free hotel shuttles to and from both the airport and rail station are available. So what is a QCWA convention like? While a social aspect is high on the agenda, national conventions are also fun and educational events. The convention committee works hard at providing activities that are of great interest to its members, as well as to the spouses of their members. Here's a synopsis of the spoils. Social events. There is a meet and greet with lots of hors d'oeuvres on Friday evening. The speaker this year is Kay Craigie, N3KN, president of the American Radio Relay League. Both Kay and her husband, Carter, N3AO, are QCWA members. The next evening is the Saturday banquet and dance to the hits from our younger days. Ah, yes. Riley Hollingsworth, K4CDH, retired special counsel for the Federal Communications Commission, will be the speaker. For the meal, one can choose between York steak, chicken saltimbocca, and scrod. Finally, there is a Saturday morning farewell buffet breakfast. We obviously won't starve. There is also an assortment of prize drawings planned. There are lots of outstanding programs presented at QCWA conventions also. The educational aspect of these annual events is what attracts many attendees. Here's a partial list of what you will enjoy in Warwick. QRP Made Easy by Steve Kersell, Alpha Alpha 4 Alpha Kilo. Steve will explain the surprisingly many advantages of QRP operations. QRP is very low power transmitting, folks. How to make propagation work to your advantage and many techniques for working worldwide DX using simple wire antennas. Vintage Radio Museum by John Ellsworth, the director. John will talk and show photos of the Vintage Radio and Communications Museum of Connecticut and will have equipment on display. There are options toward the end of the get-together for people to go to that communications museum in Connecticut. It's only a few miles across the border in Connecticut from Rhode Island. Handy Hams by Phil Temples, K9HI. Phil will discuss his volunteer work with the Handy Hams program and what he has gained from it. He will show a video made at a Handy Hams summer camp that shows the success and enthusiasm of the participants. QSL Card Checking by Steve Kersell. Steve will check cards for DXCC, WAS, WAC, and VUCC. So, If you're into hamming and have been for a long time, you want your cards checked for possible award presentations, bring your cards. Tangier Island 2011 IOTAD Expedition by Vic Culver, W4VIC. Vic will present an illustrated talk about the trip made by Team Chapter 119, from logistics to the celebration after. There is something of interest for me in all these presentations. Being a radio history lover, I am very pleased to see two programs scheduled in that sphere of interest. One other important item would be QCWA's annual membership meeting. Most conventioners will be returning home on Sunday. However, if you're in no hurry, there is the Monday special post-convention tour of the ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut. It includes the possibility of operating the Hiram Percy Maxwell Memorial Station, W1AW. This station has been faithfully serving the amateur radio community with on-air bulletins and code practice sessions for many decades. Maxim was founder and first president of the American Radio Relay League. If you have had your appetite whetted sufficiently to attend, the best thing to do is to visit the QCWA website. It's www.qcwa.org. On the home page, you will see the link SEP 9-11 QCWA Convention, Warwick, Rhode Island. That will take you to a PDF document containing an application form for the convention, its social events and tours. Then select what you want for an awesome weekend. Annual national conventions are just one perk of QCWA membership. If you were first licensed as a radio amateur in 1986 or before, and are currently licensed as one, why not consider joining QCWA and enjoy the camaraderie of other fellow veterans of our great hobby? You'll be glad you did. That concludes the commentary provided by the Quarter Century Wireless Association, QCWA, about the Rhode Island preparation for the QCWA invasion. This article was filed by Dave Hayes, Victor Echo 3, Juliet X-Ray. Up next are ham fests and special events for the month of July. Waynesville, North Carolina, WCARS Ham Fest is July 30th at Haywood County Fairgrounds, Waynesville, North Carolina. It's sponsored by the Western Carolina Amateur Radio Society. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, the 36th Annual Ham Holiday 2011. The date, July 29 and 30. That's presented by Central Oklahoma Radio Amateurs. It's at the Biltmore Hotel Conference Center in Oklahoma City. Oshkosh, Wisconsin, Special Event Station, W9ZL, Whiskey 9, Zulu, Lima, from EAA Air Venture 2011. That's July 27 through 31. It's the world's largest air show and fly-in. Fox City's Amateur Radio Club will operate W9ZL from the EAA grounds. Oak Creek, Wisconsin, South Milwaukee Amateur Radio Club 44th Annual Swap Fest is July the 9th. It's at the American Legion Post, number 434, on South Shepherd Avenue in Milwaukee. North Bend, Nebraska, Pioneer Amateur Radio Club's 14th Annual Flea Market at St. Charles Parish Center, North Bend, Nebraska. In Kimberton, Pennsylvania, the Valley Forge Ham Fest and Computer Fair, July the 17th at the Kimberton Fire Company Fairgrounds. That's on Route 113 in Kimberton, Pennsylvania. It's sponsored by the Mid-Atlantic Amateur Radio Club. Indianapolis, Indiana, the Indianapolis Ham Fest, July the 9th. As I look at the rest of the information, it doesn't exactly tell me where it is, but I guess you get a fair guess that it might be Indianapolis, Indiana. Hi. Let's take a look now at the YLs. There was commentary at the very beginning by the editor, referring to Cheryl Muir. Her amateur call again is N0WBV. A fond farewell. In 2002, I took over writing the Wild Column for World Radio, when it was still a printed magazine. In that time, I have had the pleasure of making many new friends, both from people contributing to the column and those who sent in comments upon reading it. I have one thing to say. Thank you. After nearly 9 years of authorship, it is time to pass the torch and keep this column fresh. I have enjoyed finding out what all the YLs are doing in amateur radio and plan on reading all the new happenings. I hope to even find myself doing something worth contributing to Jennifer O'Connell, KI60IL, as she proceeds with keeping us up to date with YL events, contests, and much, much more. I haven't given up ham radio or being involved. I'm a regular at the Buckeye Bell, YLRL, that's the Young Ladies Radio League, booth at the Dayton Hamvention, and plan on attending the YLRL convention in Boston this month. Of course, there is still the matter of finishing up my YL Friendship Award for 2011, and I have my colors picked out to give as an exchange. Plus, I have yet to hit the unofficial YL net on Thursday nights for this year. So much left to pursue. It has been a pleasure to be your contact with the YL world of amateur radio for so long, and I hope to meet you on the bands in the future. For now, so long. And here's a warm welcome to Jennifer, KI60IL, as the new YL columnist for World Radio Online. Keep sending her YL news. It's signed 33 and 73 Sherald and 0 WBV. The YL column commentary begins now with "Allow me to introduce myself." That's a line from one of my favorite movies, 1997's Austin Powers International Man of Mystery, and a way of telling you I'm not only an avid YL, but a film junkie too. This is Jennifer Oliver O'Neill, KI60IL, and I am humbly taking the reins from Cheryl. These are big shoes to fill, and I hope you find my offerings both interesting and worth the read. My affair with amateur radio started back in 2006 when my boyfriend invited me to come to one of his W6SD, San Fernando Valley Amateur Radio Club meetings. Fortunately, as I fell in love with him, I also fell in love with this hobby. Being a woman who doesn't have hobbies, I decided it was worth pursuing. With my OM, Lynn O'Connell, that's her husband, KG60NY's encouragement, I finally took the technician class exam, passed, and got my ticket. Lynn also upgraded to husband right around that time. In 2009, I upgraded to general class, and once I learn Morse code and get more practice experience, I plan to go for my extra. Because we're often mobile, I spend most of my time on 2 meters with a little handheld ICOM ICV-8, making use of the repeaters to check into nets and get the lowdown on the Southern California ham community. It is my hope not only to write about all the news on YLs around the nation and world, but to do profiles of YLs who are active making a stamp on this hobby. My OM and I regularly provide communications for a stage of the annual Baker to Vegas Challenge Cup relays using an HTX212 2-meter mobile transceiver. Joy Matlock, call KD6FJV, is the communications director for the event and does a tremendous job. If I can ever pin her down, I hope to get an interview so you can read about her work. Our last ham adventure was in early May for the Military Radio Collectors Group annual retreat in San Luis Obispo, California. I love the aspect of seeing how communications has changed the course of wars and our society, and seeing all those well-preserved and restored radios on display from World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and other conflicts. Lynn Fielding, KE6JCD, coordinates this event every year, and I sat down with her to get a few words and pictures, as well as talked to some of the YLs who attend with their OMs and share their love fest. So stay tuned in this column for a write-up on this enjoyable weekend. As for life outside of ham radio, I am a writer, musician, yoga instructor, and reinvention coach. Say that 5 times fast. I regularly write the faith and community page for examiner.com And I was editor of the ARRLLAX section-wide newsletter for 2 years. I've traveled to Sri Lanka, Haiti, and Ghana on mission trips, so my hope is to do a de-expedition one of these days. In the meantime, I know some YL's planning a de-expedition this year, so writing about them will suffice for now. I look forward to communicating with you through this column and maybe on the air. 33 and 77, Jennifer Oliver O'Connell, call KI6OIL. Now, folks, we have Jennifer's email here if you're inclined to want to comment to her on the internet. I'll give it to you slowly. It's a little bit long because her name is long in a way. joliveroconnell@gmail.com. The first part, of course, is her name, her initial, and then her full name, joliveroconnell@gmail.com. Welcome to the fold, Jennifer. Let's go now to the DX world. DXing is the term in amateur radio that indicates that you, the operator, is talking with or sending code back and forth to a country or territory outside of the contiguous United States. A View from the Other Side of the Pileup. The author is Kelly Jones and Zero VD. This month's DX World is a bit of potpourri. First, WRO promotion and recruitment columnist Devere D. Logan, W1HEO, takes a moment to reflect on his recent de-exposition to Aruba. Having been on the other side of pileups myself, I can relate to what D. endured. As he points out, before you jump in, always keep in mind what is happening on the DX side. Having that knowledge will certainly help get the QSO in the lock. He writes, after 40-plus years of DXing and achieving number one DXCC honor roll status, it occurred to me that a great many DXers had provided me with those needed contacts. Many had endured major risks, spent lots of money, and seldom complained about their DXpedition's difficulties in providing a rare one. So I decided it was time for me to make a contribution, small though it would be. I decided to leave my cozy radio shack and head for a Caribbean island. As a senior, I couldn't handle the heavy lifting of carrying my own gear, so I found a top contest station. That station called Papa 40 Victor, P40V. That was available for rent. That's legal. From April 2 through 16, my ex-YL, that's the wife, and I were away from snowy Ohio preparing for 2 weeks of mostly ham radio and very little time in the sun. We decided that life on the other side of the pileup is certainly different. Instead of listening for a single DX station, we were the DX station, and picking out individual calls was often difficult. At times, we had to go by call numbers in order to weed out the dozens of callers. One thing we tried to do was to announce QRZ after completing a contact in order to signal we were listening, not transmitting. Now, for the listener, QRZ is another Q signal. In amateur radio lingo, that means that we're welcoming anybody to call us on the frequency that they are hearing us. This one point is worth stressing to new DXers. Listen, listen, and listen some more. We would suggest that the stations with an advantage often call on the edge of the pileup, or give their call signs quickly before the pileup volume became too high, or even a less to give their call. While partial calls are discouraged by many DX veterans, there were times when that's all I could hear, and so I called them. Our goal was to give an Aruba contact to as many as we could. At times, working stations rapidly without a break would wear us out, so we had to QRX, that's stand by, to catch our breath. Yet, despite taking time out for meals and some sightseeing, we managed to work almost 2,000 stations over the 2 weeks. As I work through piles of QSLs, those are the postcards that hams send each other to confirm an actual talk with one another, I do note a few common errors. First, please send an SASE, or return postage. SASE is self-addressed stamped envelope, or return postage. The DX station simply may not have the funds to handle it. Also, keep your station clock accurate and on GMT. That's Greenwich Mean Time, International Time. And be sure the date is correct. We have many QSL cards with errors requiring a log search. The next time you work a DX station, pause to reflect on what that operator is contributing to your QSO. It's probably not a casual stroll on a beach. Now, referring to the art of listening, thanks to Dee for his insights and retrospective. He is a veteran DXer and author of the book titled Tips to the Top from DX Pros, and points out a couple of noteworthy items, the most important being about the importance of listening. I bring this up because recently I was working around the shack and had the rig on for background noise. I was listening to a relatively common DX country on 17 meters, but rare enough that the operator was able to run a small pileup. It was obvious the DX station had plenty of experience handling pileups, as he was able to work guys at a pretty good clip. However, at one point it became obvious he was having a little trouble copying calls, so he decided to work by the numbers. The idea behind this, as Dee points out, is to thin the number of callers to a smaller group, which makes picking out calls on the DX side much easier. Now, in parentheses, the DX station specifies he or she wants, for example, only operators with 7 in their call sign or from certain areas to transmit. Close parentheses. There are some who believe this is a good idea, while others tend to disagree. I won't be into the ideologies around working by the numbers, but it is effective in limiting the number of callers, assuming everybody cooperates. That brings me to the next point. As this particular DX station began working by the numbers, there was one station in New Jersey that would call the DX station regardless of who was being worked or what call area was being requested. At first, I ignored the fact this DXO was calling out of turn, but it got to the point where it became obvious he was blatantly ignoring the situation. By the time the DX station began working sevens, I had to jump in and ask why this particular 2 call area would call after every QSO. I pointed out that the DX station was working by the numbers and that New Jersey in 2 land was not part of 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7 land. Of course, this upset the W-2 and he chastised me for questioning his operating habits. He finally stopped calling, though, until the DX station came back around to 2s. Here's the thing. If the DX is asking for a call sign or a partial call sign, and it's not you, don't call. If the DX station is working by the numbers and you're not in that call area, don't call. This is not just simple courtesy, but it also affects everyone trying to work the DX. What? It affects everyone? Yes, and I'll explain. If the DX is asking for call area 4, then he only wants stations located in call area 4 to answer him. This decreases the size of the pileup on his end, making it easier to pick out a call sign. Because he is able to pick out calls quicker, simple math tells us he will be able to work more callers. This increases your chance of getting into the log. Now, if the DX is asking for call area 4 and you're in call area 2, then all you're doing is making QRM for him, that's extra noise or duplicated frequency noises, and decreasing his ability to pick out call signs and lowering the chance of not only you getting in the log, but everyone else as well. The longer it takes for him to get a call, the fewer stations he will be able to work. In fact, there have been countless times when I've listened to DX stations simply QRT, that's leave the air, because operators in the pileup would not cooperate. Now, not only did you not get in the log because you were in the wrong call area, but everyone else is boxed out because the DX operator became frustrated and simply turned off his radio. The same things hold true if the DX station can get only a partial call. How many times have you heard the DX ask, "Who's the Papa Charlie?" If your call sign does not contain the letters P and C, then stand by. Both of these scenarios involve listening, listening, and listening some more. Understand what the DX is asking for and respond only if it's applicable to you. Not only is it common courtesy and good operating practice, but you'll have a better chance of getting into the log and very likely a lot quicker than by simply calling over and over again. Finally this month, if you happen to be in the southwestern United States during the first weekend of August, be sure to check out the 2011 ARRL Rocky Mountain Division Convention in Taos, New Mexico. This year's convention will be held at the Sagebrush Inn and Convention Center on August 5 through 7. I was fortunate enough to be a forum speaker during the 2009 Division Conference, and we'll once again be bringing a few DX topics to the 2011 conference. A couple of celebrities will also be in attendance. Former FCC Special Counsel for Amateur Radio, Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, and the Expedition Extraordinaire, Chip Margellis, K7JA, are a couple of confirmed guest speakers. There are many activities scheduled through the weekend. Complete details can be found on the convention website at www.2011convention.org. It seems like a perfect way to wrap up your summer activity calendar. That's it for this month's column. A special thanks to Dee Logan, W1HEO, for sharing his recent de-expedition experiences. I look forward to hearing your comments, complaints, or whatever is on your mind. If you have a story or opinion you would like to share, please send it to me at, it's an amateur call, N0VD, at dxcentral.com. N0VD at dxcentral.com. I'll do my best to include it in an upcoming column. Look for me on Facebook or Twitter as well. And until next time, see you in the pileups. Kelly Jones, November 0, Victor Delta. Now, for those folks that have receivers and perhaps are shortwave listeners, SWL listeners, I'll give you a little information about the contest corner, about ham radio activities around the world for the next few weeks. The Radio Amateurs of Canada are going to have the RAC Canada Day. That's on July the 1st from 0 Zulu to 2359 Zulu. For those of you into teletype, the DL-DX RTTY contest is July the 2nd and 3rd. It's on 80 through 10 meters RTTY, slant digital. The MIQRP 4th of July sprint, that's 2300 Zulu July 4 through 0300 July 5. FISTS, summer sprint, FISTS. The date there is July the 8th, 2000 hours to 2359 Eastern Daylight Time. The band or mode, 80 meters through 10 meters, CW, that's Morse code. The IARU HF World Championship, July the 10th, 1200 Zulu July 9 through 1200 Zulu July 10th. The bands and modes, 160 through 10 meters. It's both CW and single sideband. North American QSO Party, July 16th and 17th. It's 80 meters through 10 meters, RTTY. And next up is the really big VHF contest, very high frequency operations at CQ, Worldwide VHF Contest. It begins 1800 Zulu, the 16th of July, and concludes 2100 Zulu the 17th of July. The bands and mode, of course, are VHF-oriented, 6 and 2 meters. Run for the Beacon. That's 17 July, 2100 to 2300 p.m. Eastern Time. And the last one I have here in the contest corner for this month is the NAQCC Sprint. The date and times is 0030 through 0230 Zulu, 22 July. The bands and modes 80, 40, 20 meters CW. That's Morse code. Let's take a peek now at hams in class, the CELLY, C-E-L-L-Y, using EMR and topography to prove a point. The other here is Carol Perry, WB2MGP. In the 6 years since I've retired from teaching Introduction to Amateur Radio to 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, I've been very impressed with the changes in curriculum, especially in the sciences. As technology changes, science teachers incorporate the changes in their lessons, along with changes in motivations, because society and its children continue to change as well. I've had many opportunities to visit schools across the country and to observe some of the new and timely issues and concerns, such as energy conservation, radiation exposure, digital communications, and so on, being included in lessons and discussions in the classroom. Always on the lookout for candidates for the Radio Club of America Young Achiever Award, I go to science fairs and speak with students who have demonstrated creativity in wireless communications. I have compiled a very interesting collection of student-driven and teacher-inspired experiments that can be used by teachers or instructors who have included ham radio in their curriculum. Back in the 1980s, I could thrill my students with demonstrations of a 2-meter auto patch. In today's classrooms, teachers have to remind the students to shut off their electronic devices that are always with them. So the smart teacher uses today's technology and helps the kids better understand what they're plugged into. Here's a popular experiment that the students loved working on at the school in Florida. I watched it being introduced and am pleased to pass it along as a project you can modify to best apply to your own class. The topic is cellular phone EMR and topography. The materials needed are two people, each with a cell phone, wristwatch with second hand, a detailed map of your area, and a notebook. The teacher taught a few days of background by having the students identify cell towers in their neighborhoods. They had previously done a lesson on microwave towers in their town. Cell phones use radio signals that are received and transmitted through communications towers, each of which services a small zone called a cell. You can see cell towers all over the country. The call is passed along from one cell tower to the next as it moves through an area's cells. Cell phones have low power transmitters in them, usually operating at 0.75 to 1 watt of power. The radio waves that send the encoded signal are made of electromagnetic radiation. The function of an antenna is to launch and receive radio waves. In this case, these waves are sent from your cell phone and picked up by a receiver in the cell phone tower. Electromagnetic radiation, EMR, is made up of waves of energy moving at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. These waves can be bent, deflected, focused, or even blocked, depending on certain geographical conditions. The teacher stressed that with today's technology, it's possible to geolocate a person using a cellular phone down to a range of a few meters anywhere on the planet. With a basic understanding of the technology involved, over the course of a week, the students made calls from different locations to a stationary location. The calls were made at the same time of day. Coverage quality was rated according to how quickly the connection was made, the clarity of the people's voices, and the consistency of signal. No breaking up. The hypothesis is that coverage will vary according to topographical features present in the initiating caller's location. Over the course of a week, a daily 2-minute call time was coordinated with a friend. Morning is best, since later in the day, increased radio wave traffic from other devices can degrade your connection and skew your results. The class then used a local area map and chose 8 locations, which varied each day, near buildings, in an open area, from a high place, between trees, near water, and so on. The weather was not a factor. It was mild every day. The signals were rated on a scale of 1 to 10, with the highest numbers indicating a better signal. Students wrote their numbers on the map they had used and compared the signal strength with the topography of the area. As predicted, the topography influenced the quality of the cell phone signal. Most signals that were rated 1 through 4 were from buildings, especially when surrounded by other tall buildings. It was also observed that the height of the transmission played a role in the signal strength. Since higher places have fewer obstacles, the strength of the signal increased from rooftops. While calls from the wooded area of a park were not generally very good, the signal of the cell phone increased greatly when the students went into an open field. I referred the teacher to a World Radio Online column I wrote in September 2009, highlighting the experiment done by the ARGYL, that's the Amateur Radio Group for Youth, in Lowell. Kids with their teacher Al Ekman, WW8WW. They did a Let's Go Mobiling presentation at my Dayton Youth Forum where they described how they had tested the signals from their handheld radios in different locations, such as a hot air balloon, a locomotive, and a plane. The teacher was then able to show her students how a cell phone is really a radio. There's not a big difference between a cell phone and a simple 3-transistor walkie-talkie that most of us probably played with as kids. Because of the use of towers in each cell, there is more extensive frequency reuse across the city, which means millions of people can use cell phones simultaneously. Always make technology lessons appropriate and relevant to the age level of your students. What could be more relevant to teens in today's world than working with the technology of cell phones to introduce studies about radio? Be sure to share your interesting class experiments with the rest of us who are interested in high-motivation technology lessons. Also, be on the lookout for me for that technology-gifted and creative youngster in high school or middle school who might qualify for an RCA Young Achiever Award. For more information about that, you can visit the RCA website. It's http://www.radioclubofamerica.org. www.radioclubofamerica.org. Ladies and gentlemen, this about brings me up to time for this month's reading of World Radio Online in digest format for July 2011. World Radio is published by CQ Communications, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor, Richard Fisher, KI6SN. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Always spell Handyham, lowercase H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, handyham@courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right on Buzzards Bay. Maybe you'll go by me in a few weeks, right along Interstate 195 near Exit 12 on your way to good old Cape Cod. If you choose to comment to me, good, bad, or otherwise, I hope good, you can email me at my call sign, n1blf@comcast.net. Have a great summer. 73's Bob Zeta.